So I would like to start by talking about the context of the work that I would be focusing most on, which is a phonological problem from French. But to situate that work appropriately, I'd like to take a little bit of time at the beginning to discuss the research program that this is part of, that it comes out of. On this slide, I'll mostly be mentioning things I will not talk about today in the talk, but we'll be happy to discuss in the question period. There was a major crisis that emerged in cognitive science roughly in the 1980s when connectionism became part of the mainstream. The crisis concerned the nature of the cognitive architecture. What kind of computation is it that we have in our mind brain? And the fundamental issue there is whether computation in the mind brain should be formalized as symbolic computation, the kind of computation that we're familiar with from formal linguistics, where data is in the form of symbols in highly structured form, and knowledge takes the form of rules or constraints stated over those symbols. The problem is whether computation of the symbolic sort should be taken as paradigmatic of computation in the mind brain, or whether neural network or connectionist computation should be, which is more natural from the perspective of the brain. So by that kind of computation, I mean we have processing distributed over a number of simple processing elements, which are either actual neurons or model neurons, simplified for mathematical analysis, and where representation isn't a set of symbols, it's just a whole bunch of numbers. It's the activation values of all of the neurons in this network. And knowledge isn't a bunch of rules or constraints stated over symbols. Knowledge is a bunch of numbers. It's the connections between the units in the network. So there was a lot of debate about which of these was the appropriate form to study cognition. And rather than trying to decide one way or the other, what I have been involved in for many years is trying to unify these two kinds of computation into a single kind of computation. That's what we call gradient symbolic computation. You can read a little bit about it in these places, I'll give you a very high-level overview of the nature of this kind of computation, because that's the wellspring from which this main project comes. So a representation in GSC, one and the same representation, can be described in two ways. It can be described at an abstract level, in which case what you have is a bona fide symbol structure, or it can be described at a more fine-grained level, where you have a bunch of numbers, which together, if you list all these numbers, which are the activation values of all the neurons in the network, that's what we call an activation vector. So it can be described as an activation vector or a symbol structure. The name for these kinds of representations is tensor product representations, because it's the outer or the tensor product operator that's used to bind the vectors that encode symbols to the vectors that encode the roles in the structures that they form. Now, the problem of unifying computation over vectors with computation over symbols is something I've been working on for off and on for 30 years. But for most of those three decades, nobody else seemed to think this was a problem of any interest. Either people thought that the whole approach to encoding knowledge through symbol structures was ill-conceived, and that, of course, its brain doesn't have symbols, of course. Or they were sold on the symbolic level and didn't see any benefit from going down to a level closer to the neural network. So everyone had their preferred level. I was trying to unify the two. In the last few years, though, a number of factors have converged And suddenly, it's of great interest in computational linguistics to figure out how neural networks and symbolic computation, symbolic grammars, for example, can be integrated. That's because in the last 10, 15 years, neural networks have led to very major advances in natural language processing, have improved speech recognition systems and text processing systems enormously. But the question is, one part of this natural language processing system is a network. It has representations that take the form of numerical vectors. Lots of the rest of the natural language processing system is dealing with symbolic representations, as it always has. And getting these two things to work coherently together is a challenge. And the approach of gradient symbolic computation is to say that actually it's not that we have the symbols here and the neurons here. We have just one system which can be described in terms of neural operations or symbol structures. Okay, so in addition to these aspects of representation that makes GSC unique, in GSC, knowledge takes the form of weighted constraints. These are elements of a probabilistic harmonic grammar. These are constraints that can be described at the symbolic level in the way that we used to doing in linguistics. But they also are implemented in terms of connections in the neural network. And they drive processing to form well-formed or optimal representations. The adequacy I should say that there are two classes of networks that I have developed in this general approach that are used for somewhat different purposes. And the adequacy of the processing and overall computational architecture has been evaluated over the years in many ways. So on the symbolic side, the extent to which this does adequate justice to symbolic computation, it's been shown that using a GSC, we can compute recursive functions. We can do beta reduction from lambda calculus, tree adjoining, and some kinds of logical inference. We can asymptotically compute, or at least specify, formal languages of all levels of complexity. And as far as linguistic theory is concerned, harmonic grammar and optimality theory have been pursued by many linguists to some successful results in fields and levels ranging from phonology to pragmatics. On the neural network side, the adequacy of this form of unification, it is manifest in certain computational results, theorems about the convergence of the activation spread processes within these neural networks to converge to a global harmony maximum, which is the optimal representation that we desire to compute. And currently, with colleagues at Microsoft Research, I am pursuing applications to question answering the semantic parsing of natural language processing. On the real neural side, the biological neural side, the adequacy of this concept, this architecture, is far from established. There's some expectations, but in the coming year, I hope that we'll be able to push that much further using these methods to understand how combinatorial language representations are actually manifest in the brain. And together, the symbolic side and the neural network side are being used now to try to develop psycholinguistically adequate models of sentence production and comprehension. So, all of this is some evidence that there is that this GSC architecture does give us a lot of the power that symbolic computation provides and that neural computation provides. But what's most important for today is a certain kind of prediction that comes out of it. And this is something that has not been attended to in this research program until relatively recently. And that is a very, very general prediction that it's not just discrete structures that that populate the space of representations in GSC. There are also things that are called gradient symbol structures, and most representations actually are this kind. And so the prediction is that they should be somehow playing an important role in cognition, and it's the current focus to try to understand what that role might be. Let's see. Let me give you, I will just say for now that a gradient symbol structure is something which has the structure of a discrete representation. Maybe it's a tree, maybe it's an auto-segmental kind of multi-tiered representation. It has that kind of structure to it, but the elements in it aren't just discrete symbols. They are symbols that have activity levels, and they are blended together such that at a particular place in a phonological string, for example, you might have a blend of multiple phones, each present to a certain degree, given by what we call its activity. So most of the representations in GSC are of this form. And so we're trying to explore what value these kinds of representations have for developing linguistic theory and other applications. And today we're going to be talking at the symbolic level. I'll be talking about the neural network level. I'll be talking about how these gradient symbol structures in lexical representations can give us some leverage on a problem in French phonology to do with liaison consonants. Okay, so why do I think it's worth trying to go beyond the classical symbol structures of grammatical theory, which I know of? It's because of the following fundamental issue that I believe is just a fact of life. Symbolic analyses in linguistics give a lot of insight, but typically they don't quite work. It's frustrating because they give you so much insight, yet they don't quite work almost invariably. And the hypothesis that we're pursuing here is that with blended gradient symbol structures, we can actually help resolve long-standing impasses in linguistic theory that result from the fact that no single analysis does all the work that linguists would like to see done. So a situation that arises all the time is that there are competing analyses in the literature. A is a structure that has been posited to explain some phenomenon X. B is a different structure that's been posited. And these two alternative theories can last for decades and no resolution arises. And the proposal is that the reason is that, in fact, X arises from a blend of these two structures, and that neither one alone captures everything that needs to be put into the correct structural description of X. And today, X is going to be French liaison. The work also looks at elision of vowels, but I won't be talking about that. So these are the phenomena concerns consonants that alternate with zero. So the intermediate T here in petit ami is a phone that surfaces in that environment, but then does not surface in petit coca. The two structures A and B here that I will be trying to blend together are first, that underlyingly, the first word in this phrase is has a final T which is somehow deficient. It's because it's deficient that it doesn't always surface. And that the second word, ami, is just lexically stored in a vowel initial straightforward form. The alternative analysis, which has been around a long time and still has its fans, is that actually this T belongs to the second word, not the first. That ami is underlyingly T initial. But actually, there are also other forms of it. So it's actually a set of allomorphs that have to be selected by the preceding form. So the T selects the T initial allomorph. That's the analysis B that puts this consonant in the second word. And we'll be looking at an analysis that blends the two of those together to try to cover both the data that this gives us a good handle on and the data that this seems to, that data that seems to require something like structured heat. Just want to thank Jay Culverson for pointing out that this is an excellent problem to look at for purposes of testing this blending of hypotheses with gradients and null computation. And I want to mention a reference that Eric Bakovich pointed me to, which goes back a long way, to a paper in which George Hankinger said that we have to give up the assumption that two or more conflicting analyses cannot be simultaneously correct, that for certain constructions, we must have both analyses at once in the conjunctive sense. That conjunctive sense is exactly what we need here. The analysis we're going to provide requires that the T be both at the end of the first word and at the beginning of the second one. So the blending that's happening here is not a probabilistic blend where with some probability it's here and then probability it's there. It's really a conjunctive blend in which the partially active elements are simultaneously present. Okay, so I'd like to show in this talk how gradient Sonnard representations can give us some sort of enlightening accounts of many of the phenomena that have been claimed to occur in the rich scope of liaison. I'm just going to put aside the divergent views on the actual empirical status of many of these phenomena. I'm going to use this as an opportunity to explore a situation where the divergences that involve to some extent disagreements about the empirical phenomena, but more crucially, disagreements about the direct analysis. To show how this instantiates a situation where no single analysis quite works. And to show that, in fact, gradient symbolic representations can help resolve this impasse. This is a theoretical explanation. It's not an empirical argument. The facts are much too murky for me to try to give a definitive empirical argument, although I'm currently spending some time in France trying to get some clearer handle on the facts so that it can be pushed to an empirical argument. But also, there is the point that it takes quite a lot of theoretical exploration of a new framework before it's really appropriate to seek empirical validation. If you don't know what the framework can do, then of course, how can you sensibly go about determining whether it's making the right predictions? And when it comes to GSC, just exploring what it can do, what kind of predictions it leads to, is in and of itself an important step in trying to assess its validity. The approach to liaison takes some inspiration from a very interesting paper by David Dowdy, in which he addressed structural ambivalence, again, a situation where there are competing analyses, one in which prepositional phrases are complements, the other in which they are adjuncts. What Dowdy sketched in this paper is the idea that children initially form a simple, maximally general analysis, in which adjuncts contribute through compositional semantics, and that over time adults end up with a more complex, specialized analysis in which complements can have idiosyncratic semantics that govern by their verb. But the interesting point is that Dowdy argues that the original analysis that children form of the adjunct analysis persists in adulthood and coexists with the more complex analysis. And that the two function jointly in the adult brain. In some slow psychological way, he says, in online processing, though in a way that only connectionism or some other weird thing could possibly explain, they coexist and work together, and that's what GSC allows us to actually formalize. Okay, so liaison in French. There are four parts to the talk. So first I'll talk about gradient symbolic computation in a little bit more depth. Then talk about the adult blend, the grammar of French that we're proposing, which blends in the gradient and symbolic computation, the two competing analyses I mentioned earlier. By starting with the phonological phenomenon, the idea of the analysis, the formal account, some speculations about how Dowdy's sketch could be carried out in the context of this analysis, and some tentative suggestions of the role of prosody in the phenomenon. And I may have to skip some of these depending on how time is going, so I just give you a warning about that. All right, so a nano introduction to gradient symbolic computation. Here's an example of a gradient symbolic representation. It can be looked at in two ways. Neither one has any special priority over the other. You can look at this as a very simple local tree in which the left child role is filled by a blend of symbols, A with a degree of presence or activity 0.7, B with degree 0.2. This is a kind of structure that we have found useful in phenology, where elements tend to stay in place while changing their, say, feature content. But you can also look at the same structure as the symbol A in a blend of two roles, mostly in the left position, but partly in the right position as well. And we have found this useful for syntactic analysis where elements tend to change their place or occupy multiple roles. And again, these numbers here, we refer to as activity levels. There's something like a degree of presence in the representation. Here's an example of what we'll actually be working with. This is a lexical representation, the input to the phonological grammar for Petit Panini. We have the lexical entry for Petit, which has a T with activation or activity level lambda at the end. And we have Ami here, which has at the beginning a blend of partially active symbols for all of the productive liaison consonants of French, including T. So these Greek letters stand for numbers, which we'll make concrete later. Now, in fact, in reality, a state in gradient symbolic computation is a probability distribution over these kinds of representations. It's not just a single one, but most of the time you ignore that fact. And as I mentioned, gradient symbolic representations are implemented in a neural network as distributed activity patterns. And it's that implementation in terms of numerical activation values which allows us to formalize the notion of blend of symbols or blend of roles. I won't go through that, spelling that out, but we can come back to it for those interested in such things. The underlying architecture has neural networks that spread activation in a stochastic or random way to optimize well-formed harmony. But we're not going to be dealing with the dynamics today either. We're just going to exploit the fact that the outcome of the dynamics is a representation that maximizes a well-formed mismeasure harmony, which is the weighted sum of violations of a set of constraints. Each constraint has a numerical weight. And so this set of constraints with their weights constitutes a harmonic grammar. It's like an empty grammar, but instead of ranking, we have numerical strength for the constraints. Harmonic grammar has a long history, actually. So if you're out of harmony theory, one of the papers that Anna mentioned, which is a neural network architecture that does harmony maximization, which then led to harmonic grammar, which led to optimality theory, and then now in recent years, harmonic grammar has gotten some renewed attention as a counter hypothesis to optimality theory for how constraints interact and how typological variation is manifest. But what's new is the notion that the representations are gradient. Not just the strengths of the constraints, but the representations themselves have gradient symbols in them. And one thing I'll also add is that there's some emphasis in this project on trying to understand the harmonic grammar analysis. One reason that it was a real relief to move from harmonic grammar to optimality theory in 1991 was that these grammars, you really could understand what they were saying. about a phenomenon. Harmonic grammars, so Girardi was wondering when I did a harmonic grammar analysis of accusativity in French back in 1990 with a whole bunch of constraints on their weights, and we had learning algorithms for learning weights and the whole nine yards. And understanding what it was saying about the phenomenon was just impossible. So it was a model, but in terms of doing what we want a linguistic theory to do, it just didn't seem to cut it. But today I'm going to give put some emphasis on understanding the harmonic grammar analysis of liaison, not just writing it down. Okay. The core phenomena associated with liaison are straightforward enough. Here we have four different collocations. In the first one, we get a T pronounced between the two words, a little friend, literally speaking. And here we don't get the T manifest. Here we get it again, this time in coda position. Here we get no T, even though we have hiatus. So we have this alternation that needs to be understood. And the generalizations are that in this word here, we only get a T at the end of it when that precedes a vowel, as in this case, but not this case. But it doesn't always appear prior to a vowel. There are certain words, most, if not all, written with an H, which isn't pronounced. So they're pronounced as vowel initially, but the consonant T does not appear before them. These are the so-called Ash-Askaray words. And then there are forms in which a final T gets pronounced everywhere, like this feminine version of a little here. So in this form, this one here, we could say that T surfaces only when it's needed to provide a syllable onset. That's not needed here, but is needed here. But before this form, AO here, we don't get a T despite the lack of an onset. So complications arise already in the very basic pattern. It's clear, though, that the universal constraints on syllable well-formedness are playing some kind of role, even though all these possibilities do appear on the surface from different inputs. So our analysis will deploy these universal constraints that syllables should have onsets and should not have quotas. But there's quite a bit more to the story than that. So what is the distinction between the T at the end of petit, which always surfaces even before a consonant, and the T at the end of petit and petit ami, which only surfaces before a vowel? What is the underlying distinction in the lexicon between the liaison consonant of this form and the fixed consonant of this form? So we'll be talking about the problem in terms of these mappings. We've just talked about four mappings. They perhaps provide the core of the phenomenon, these four kinds of examples here. So I'll be talking about them schematically as these kinds of mappings. This hollow V marking the Ash Aspire words. Let's see. Okay, so the proposal for how the contrast is marked underlyingly is through activity levels. We're going to say that a fixed, like we have a petite feminine, is a fully active consonant, activity value 1. But the liaison consonant is deficient in activity. It is literally weak. It has activity less than 1 in the underlying form. Otherwise, it's exactly like its full counterpart in content. It differs only in activity. The point is that the liaison consonant can only surface if it is provided extra activity. It doesn't have enough activity on its own to surface. Okay, now so far, we've been following the orthography and assuming that the liaison consonant is final in the word that it follows. I'll refer to this as the final L analysis, or W1L analysis. But there are a number of phonologists who reject this theory and favor a theory in which the liaison consonant is initial in the word that it precedes, which is consistent with the syllabification. That's where it appears syllabically with the second word's body. But this requires that a given word like ami had multiple allomorphs listed in the lexicon. And the selection of the allomorph in a given context is determined by the word that precedes it. Now, some people may find this inelegant, and I would have to agree that there's a certain amount of inelegance to it. This second analysis I'll call the L initial analysis, or LW2. Okay. Now, why do people who favor this resort to this? Well, there are at least eight phenomena that I can enumerate that favor the second analysis, the L initial analysis. One of them is phrase final appearance of liaison consonants. So you have a word like this in which the final consonant behaves like the liaison consonant in every way, except it has the peculiarity that when it appears phrase finally, it actually gets pronounced. Even though it doesn't function as an onset there. There are a couple of other oddities here that I won't mention, but I'll mention this one, which says that after a prosodic break, this liaison consonant can surface along with the second word. So if it's underlining part of the first word and its appearance is determined by syllabification within the phonological phrase, then it shouldn't be jumping out into the land after the prosodic break. But if it's part of the second word, of course, then there's nothing odd about it at all. There's a frequency effect which says that in the syntactic environments where the liaison is optional, the probability that the consonant surfaces is actually related to the probability with which the second word follows the first. The probability of the second word being the first. And so, since this is about a collocation, it's actually ultimately going to be the case that neither W1's or W2's lexical entries alone can provide all the information needed to describe the phenomenon. Somehow we're going to have to be able to relate this collocation frequency to the probability that the liaison surfaces. There are a number of errors that are expected under the second analysis, but not the first. So when an incorrect consonant is substituted for the correct one, that consonant is a liaison consonant. Now, in the initial L analysis, that's totally explainable as the misselection of the allomorph. So following Putti, you're supposed to select the T initial one, but you selected the wrong one, which will begin with a different liaison consonant. When there should be hiatus, sometimes in errors, consonants are inserted there, and what gets inserted is the liaison consonant. Again, as if the liaison initial form was selected instead of the vowel initial element that should have been selected. In child language, and this gets back to the Dowdy perspective, in child language, this liaison followed by second word is in fact treated as if it were a word in which that consonant were first word. So a child will say things like joli nanini, where that N shouldn't be there unless preceded by a form which has a liaison N at the end, which joli is not, it's no consonant. Allomorph nami is treated by the child as just one alternative pronunciation of this word. This particular result here is expected given that we know that a strong heuristic for word segmentation is that words should begin at the beginning of syllables. So this is exactly how you would expect a child to parse these nasal structures. There are some challenges for the second analysis, but not the first, and the most obvious is the allomorph selection, which does not have to be, which is not necessary at all in the L-Feynman analysis. Okay, without taking the time to go into other phenomena that go well beyond what the, either one of these alone can handle, let me just say that the theory I'm about to tell you appears to be able to account for all 15 of these phenomena. And whether it does more than just give an account, but it actually gives insight or inspiration, I'll leave it to your judgment. So the analysis is based on the following idea. So remember that we have this analysis A, with the liaison consonant at the end of word one, analysis B with it appearing ongoingly at the beginning of word two. After Gowdy's idea, we're going to propose that the adult state is actually a blend of these two. We've seen that this is the child's analysis. That the adult analysis retains the child analysis and blends it into the other analysis. And how does that work? Well, here are the underlying forms that are used in this analysis. For the first word, when it has a liaison consonant, the claim is that that consonant is present at the end of the first word, but with a reduced degree of activity. The activity value is lambda, which will turn out to be 0.5 in the particular instantiation I'm going to show you. That's in contrast to words like the feminine form of petit or juiced, where the final T always is pronounced. Those are cases where you have a bona fide, fully active T in the amniotic form. The second word will be consonant initial sometimes, as in Fugna. It'll be vowel initial sometimes, and these will correspond to the ash-aspire words. So ash-aspire word like hero will be vowel initial underlyingly. But other words like ME, in which liaison consonants do appear, those which surface in isolation as vowel initial are going to be treated as underlyingly consonant initial. The initial position in this underlying form is a blend of the three productive liaison consonants, each with some reduced activity level, which will turn out to be 0.3 in the paper analysis I'm about to propose. For now, I'm assuming that these are consonants across the whole lexicon. There's no particular reason why that should be, but that's the level to which the analysis is taken at the moment. We can say that this really is a blend of the two analyses, because what we're proposing for W1 is that an underlying form which has the liaison consonant at the end, just like the analysis A says it should, but only to an extent lambda. So it blends W1L account with activity lambda. If it's for me, I'm busy. And it blends it with the other analysis in which laser is in the initial W2, and that is blended in with the strength given by these numbers, which will be 0.3. Okay, so the account for the basic cases goes like this. So when we have a canonical situation where the consonant should appear, the liaison consonant should appear, we have the first word with 0.5 activity for a final T. We have a second word with 0.3 activity for an initial T. the idea is that this extra activity from the second word boosts the overall activity of the intermediate T above some threshold that's needed in order for it to have enough activity to surface. So these two together will give enough activity to surface, and we'll get it pronounced. In the ash-aspire form, in the consonant initial forms, however, there is no partially active T And this does not get any additional activity and doesn't have enough surface latency. And in the ASPI words, they truly are vowel initial. Unlike ME, they do not have any weak consonants at the beginning. And so, we as if it were a consonant initial word, we don't have the extra activity for T that is needed for the surface, and so it doesn't. Okay. So that's the idea of the analysis. And now I'll give you a sketch of the formal analysis. I hope it'll be all right. It is late. It is hot. It is stuffy. I'll take a deep breath. Okay. Here we go. Okay, so let's look at the very first and canonical case of this petit ami. Here's our mapping that we want to achieve, the environment that we're looking at now is one in which we have a consonant between two vowels, this guy here, between two vowels. And there are two outputs of interest to us, one where the consonant surfaces and one where it doesn't. I write this environment with a capital V here with the understanding that in our analysis, this actually, or a word like ME, actually starts with a weak consonant blend, and then the vowel following. So that's the environment that I really mean. This is the input that we looked at a long time ago as an example of gradient symbolic representation. And here is a harmonic grammar tableau that we're going to use to decide which of these two is the optimal output for this input here. So here we have hiatus, no consonant. Here we have the underlying T from the first word surfacing. And here we have coalescence of the two T's. So this is the case where the activities of these two T's are going to be allowed to merge. And that's the one that's going to be the winner in the end. It violates a constraint from correspondence theory called uniformity, which says that if we have consonants T1 and T2 that in underlying form are distinct, then their correspondence in the output should be distinct. And that's what's violated in coalescence. So we will have to overcome the cost of this uniformity violation in order for that to be optimal. So here are what the other constraints look like. This is the depth constraint. And the idea of the depth constraint is that we have activity 1 in the surface of this consonant. But underlyingly, we don't have activity 1. We just have lambda and tau together. And so Jen has to provide extra activity to bring up the potential input, which has a total strength of 0.8, bring it up to the value that it has on the surface of 1. And so it has to add activity value of 0.2. The more activity that needs to be added in order to get to the surface form from the underlying form, the greater the degree of violation of depth. There's a greater degree of violation here because this T underlying it just has activity value lambda. It doesn't have lambda plus that as its underlying activity. This constraint in this analysis is given a strength of negative 10. And the numbers that you'll be seeing are not derived a priori. They're fit to the data, so truth in advertising. However, the constraints are all gradient versions of standard constraints from latent phonology. For example, the second constraint here is max. This is a positive constraint that rewards surface forms that allow underlying forms to surface. So underlying material to surface. So underlyingly, we have a total of lambda plus tau or 0.8 activity here. So how much of the input has been allowed to surface? How much input has made it to the surface? Well, 0.8. So that's the max reward. There's a smaller amount of reward here because we're only bringing to the surface the activity associated with the first of these T's, not both of them. This is an alignment constraint. that says that more foods should begin with suitable boundaries, as I mentioned earlier, as a factor in segmentation for children. Onset is good old onset. And if we look at the harmony values that result from these degrees of violation for constraints with these weights, then what we see is that the output option that has the best harmony, the least negative, is this guy here, which indeed is our coalesced liaison consonant appearing on the surface. Now, I'll point out here that we don't have multiple allomorphs for ME in the lexicon. We only have one lexical entry for ME, but itself is ambivalent about the beginning. It has multiple consonants present there. But I'm pointing out here that which of these consonants surfaces, which is the analog of deciding which allomorph to select, that is automatic. Only one of these consonants is going to be able to coalesce with the material at the end of the preceding word to provide enough activity for that consonant to surface. These guys are not going to surface because they have nobody else to lend them sufficient activity. So when will the liaison consonant surface? When is this candidate optimal? Well, we can do the math. There it is. We can ask, when is the harmony of this structure greater than the harmony of this one? For example, that's necessary for this to be optimal. Here's the harmony difference. You want to know, when is it greater than or equal to zero? And the answer is, when the total activity of the underlying t, namely lambda from the first word plus tau from the second, when that exceeds this number here, which happens to be 0.73, given the strengths of the constraints here, when this underlying total activity exceeds this threshold, this form has higher harmony than that form and is going to, in the end, be optimal. So this is, in fact, the threshold that the total activity from the input needs to exceed in order for the consonant to surface. And it's determined by the strengths of all of these constraints as they are respectively violated and satisfied in the two competitors here. So this is the strength of depth, this is the strength of uniformity, and so on. So doing the calculation of the degree of harmony of constraint violations for these two alternatives tells us what the threshold is that needs to be exceeded by the underlying consonant in order for it to be optimal for the surface. And with the choices that I gave you, 0.5 and 0.3, we do see, in fact, that the total amount of input activation is greater than the threshold, and that's why, in this particular situation, the optimal form does have the liaison consonant appearing on the surface. Okay, so we can follow the same procedure as this for all sorts of different elements in different environments. And in each case, we can just look at the competitors and see how their harmonies differ in terms of the strengths of the constraints and the strengths of the underlying underlying material. And we get different threshold values for different environments because different constraints figure into them. Okay, so here's a picture of the analysis, which can be fleshed out shortly. By looking at the constraints that are at play in the decision about whether the consonant should appear or not, we get a threshold value, and this is a threshold scale here. And then down here we have the activity of the underlying material, which is now 0.8. It's to the right, 0.73, exceeds it. It exceeds the threshold, and therefore the surface form has the T pronounced. If we have joli ami instead of petit ami, we still have the underlying T. The question still arises as to whether it's a surface or not. Answer is, well, the amount of input activity associated with T now is just tau, not tau but then just tau, which is 0.3. And 0.3 is much less than the threshold needed, and so that T will not surface in this environment. So we can add that to our picture. Here's the Joliani example. There's an underlying concept material here, but it doesn't surface because the activity of the statement in question is below the threshold for that environment. We can do the same thing for the next example where the liaison consonant is followed by a consonant instead of a nominally vowel initial word. The right answer is that the T should not surface. We can go through the math and come up with the relevant threshold for that environment. Let me just skip over it. The same kind of calculation, but gives a different threshold for that environment. The threshold ends up being now 0.84 instead of 0.73, and we do not have enough activation to exceed that threshold, and so the liaison constant doesn't surface. It only has activity of 0.5. So here's the threshold for that new environment, which is consonant final, consonant initial second word. There's its threshold. In Petit Copain, this combination, we do not have enough activation to exceed it, so it doesn't surface. In the full form, where we have a full consonant with that underlying activity 1, 1 does exceed that threshold, and so it does surface, and we get Petit Copain, or Copain, for the feminine form. So combining the examples we've looked at here, there are these two thresholds, they're associated with these two environments, different situations for full consonants, coalescing, and isolated consonants. The analysis consists of two dimensions that are crossed. On this dimension, we have different environments, each with its activity threshold that a segment needs to exceed in order to surface. And down here, we have the different segment types with their different activity levels, which may exceed some thresholds and not others, and therefore need to surface in some environments and not others. And so we get all four of the core patterns and a whole bunch of other peripheral patterns that I mentioned as complexities to the phenomenon beyond the core. And here's a less incomplete picture of the full analysis, in which we have a whole bunch of different environments with their corresponding thresholds, different types of segments, underlying them with different activity levels, and the result of whether they surface or not. So again, it's a cross of these two dimensions. And with all of these numbers running around, we need to worry about the restrictiveness of this kind of analysis. And this is far from a complete characterization of that, but let me point this out. No matter what the underlying activity of segment X is, if it surfaces in an environment with threshold theta, then it must surface in any environment with threshold less than theta. So because we have this laying out of environments here, we can't just get underlying material to surface here, but not here, and here, but not there. There is a scale here. And if an underlying segment falls in such a position as to exceed this threshold, then it must necessarily exceed these, and it must necessarily surface in those environments. And similarly, no matter what the threshold is of an environment, E, if a segment with some activity level A, less than 1, manages to surface in E, then a segment X which has greater activation than A will necessarily also surface in E. Activation will necessarily exceed the threshold for that environment. So there are scalar restrictions, implicational relationships coming from these scales, which gives a certain kind of restrictiveness to the overall distribution across environments that are allowed in this analysis. Okay, how are we doing on time here? I think I'm going to skip this section here. or I can skip the section on prosody. No regrets. there's one?
Yes.
There's one?
Okay. Two.
Two? Okay.
I think we have to do some time.
very quick, except I think this means it has one slide, so let's go. Okay. It has one slide, but I'll warn you. The slide is dubious. So there was a certain amount of lack of innocence in wanting to skip this section. So here goes. So let us see the extent to which a Gaudi-type picture of a child forming an initial analysis, which then matures to a subsequent analysis, but ends up with a blend of the two, how that looks in this particular example. So if we have an alignment constraint, which is part of the analysis that proposed that morphemes should start at the beginning of syllables, then if we use that in comprehension-directed optimization to do parsing, finding optimal breaking up into underlying forms of surface form, then we are going to see free variation for the different expressions of the same morpheme. And so we will get multiple lexical entries from this. Eventually this is going to lead to errors, though. So if you have these alternates in your lexicon and you're picking them without regard to context, then you're going to say things like joli tanu, which is not at all French. It should be joli tanu. And so let's say that the consequence of this for learning algorithms that it weakens the underlying T in tanu. That led to something on the surface that shouldn't be there. So the underlying form is going to have the activation of T reduced by, let's say, 0.1. Well, that's not going to be enough. It's still going to surface. And for the purpose of this thought experiment, I'm going to pretend that we have in place the constraint weightings that give the same kind of threshold of 0.73 as we had above. That's just a simplification. We've weakened the underlying T from 1 to 0.9, but it's still too strong. It's going to surface next time. We're going to say Joule 10 again, so it's going to have to be weakened again. And eventually, it may weaken to the point where we get below the threshold, so we're down to 0.7. In order to get this correct form, the T time, this is a case where the T allomorph should be selected. We're going to need more activity, because if we have nothing at the end of the T, and we only have a weak T at the beginning of Tandy, reduced to 0.7, now we don't have enough T to surface in this environment, so we're going to get the TME. We need more activity for T, so let's say the learning algorithm splits it. It takes that 0.1 that was working with before, gives half of it to increasing the strength of T on the left, half of it to increasing the strength of T on the right, then we end up with this pair of underlying forms now. So now the T has acquired a little bit of T. And this is not going to cause it to acquire any other consonants besides T. But this has returned to above the threshold, and so we're going to get the show attempt again, so it's going to have to be used again, and we're going to increase the strength of the T. The story is that there's a gradual shift over time where the activity, which was initially entirely at the beginning of the second word, migrates over to the first word. Activity of T migrates from here to there. The analysis that I just proposed says that in the adult form, the shift does not go all the way. We don't go all the way to word 1 with full strength 0.1. Rather, we have activity 0.5 of T at the end of word 1 and activity of 0.3 at the beginning of and other such words. Okay, so that's hand-waving about acquisition, about how we might be able to arrive at this kind of blend through a rational modification of underlying forms. Okay, positive, 15:35. I think what I would do is I will give you the punchline here. Let's see if I can use that easily. So here's the wacky idea. The idea is that sort of following along the sort of inspired by usage-based views of acquisition, we have underlying forms for W1 isolation and W2 isolation, but we hear W1 and W2 together, and we start forming a lexical entry for the collocation W1 and W2. The idea is that when we are going to produce this sequence, the input to the grammar consists of the underlying form for W1, the underlying form for W2, plus this underlying form, which is the underlying form for the collocation. And the wacky thing about it is it has negative activity associated with a morpheme boundary between W1 and W2. The point being that when you take W1 in isolation, it has a morpheme boundary at the end, and W1 at the beginning, and without any additional modification, we just have a full-blown morpheme boundary in between the two. But if you add to the lexicon this guy, and that gets added into the input, it actually weakens the morpheme boundary by a not 5. So now we have a partially active morpheme boundary between these two, not fully active. The consequence of that is, the consequence of that is that the cost of doing the coalescence that brings about realization of the liaison constant is reduced because the coalescence involves crossing a weaker boundary. That's the idea of this part of the analysis. If you've heard frequently, you get this entry which has as its job to weaken the morpheme boundary in that pair of words or comp followed by a noun. And the end result then is what goes into the grammar has an effect only 0.3 rather than 1 as the activity of the morpheme boundary. And then the penalty that's paid by coalescence of the T that's secretly at the beginning of this word in the lexicon and at the end of this one, the coalescence of those two is no longer as strong a violation as were that an infrequent kind of fiction and where this did not exist or didn't have a strong value. So that's part of the. So that's the aspect of the analysis that links frequency of the sequence W1, W2 to the cost of having the intermediate constant surface. There's another aspect to it which has to do with where in the prosodic hierarchy is the boundary between the two words. And that's where syntax actually regulates this phenomenon, but there's a zone where the prosodic boundary between W1 and W2 is not so weak that you always get liaison, not so strong that you never get it, but some intermediate place. And that's captured by assumptions about a hierarchy that parallels the prosodic hierarchy that says that the strength of the penalty that you get for crossing boundaries of morphemes and prosodic categories gets higher and higher as you go up the prosodic hierarchy, and that's what leads to the reflex of the syntactic environment in the probability of liaison. That's very short encapsulation. So let me summarize. In this analysis, the idea of gradient symbolic representation has many crucial uses, so let me just remind you about them. In the adult blend, we have partially active final consonants and partially inactive active initial consonants. So this is the formalization of Dowdy's picture for this phenomenon. There are many crucially different gradient activity levels for underlying consonants that give rise to differences in distribution across environments. So there's the strength of the consonant at the end of W1 versus the beginning of W2. The strength of the Z of plural is actually greater than other Zs, and it surfaces in environments where other Zs don't. The consonant at the end of these, this is a liaison consonant, but its activity level is slightly greater, which is what allows the surface at the end of utterances where other liaison consonants can't. Skip over that. And the acquisition story crucially involves gradually shifting activity from one locus to another. So that crucially is involving some notion of gradients and representations, underlying representations. And then the gradual increase in the lexicon of the activity of a collocation entry for a pair of words is another use of gradients in this analysis. In fact, it goes so far as to use the notion of negative activity. I'll add to all of that not only is it crucial in all these ways that the underlying forms have gradients in them, that symbols have gradient activity, but it's also crucial that the kind of grammar that's evaluating these representations be a harmonic grammar, a numerical system for weighting constraint violations, because that's what allows us to make sense of it, having different strengths of constraint violation as a function of the different underlying activity levels. And that's it. Thank you.